Justice meeting will come to order, and we do have a quorum. And Representative Dillsville, House File 208, is up first. Would somebody move? Representative Hortman moves Representative Dillsville and to the General Register. Is that correct, Representative Dill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead and present your bill.
Okay, House File 208 should be viewed, members, as a technical change. There isn't any real background on why it got done the way that it did in Section 514.20, but this is regarding a possessory lien on a motor vehicle. So when someone does work on a motor vehicle and they still have it in their possession and they haven't been paid, they have to send out a notice with specified language in it. Currently by registered mail. Now, this came to me from the Grand Marais postmaster, who apparently does this from time to time. And so he said this is not the correct method of serving a notice. He said that under current laws, that it says it has to be registered. Well, registered is sending things of value. Like if you were going to get your wristwatch repaired, or if you were going to send a signed stock certificate, or you were going to send a ring away to get a bigger diamond for your wife, things of that nature. But certified mail is for sending something simple like a letter that tells the person either they pay up or there's going to be a sheriff's sale. And a certified letter would include proof that a sender sent it, and also if you bought that green tag on the back, it would give you proof that someone received it. Who it was sent to, or someone that represented that person. And this bill changes this particular provision from registered to certified. It also saves the individual who is trying to enforce the mechanics lien about $8 every time they do it, because entry-level registered mail is about $14 for the entry-level with $25,000 worth of coverage, which would be for an expensive watch or a stock certificate, as I said. A certified letter is about $4.82. It's $5.82 if you put the green card on the back. So not only does this make it so that it specifies the proper type of service, gets notification, or you get receipt that it was sent, can get receipt that it was received, and it also costs about $8 every time left. So it's good government.
Another Ranger good government bill.
We like those on the Iron Range. Just like we like sulfide mining.
Are there any questions, discussion? Okay. Representative Hortman renews her motion to pass the bill and send it to the Civil Register. That's House File 208. Civil Register, General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, carries.
Thank you, Chair Mullery and Representative Hortman.
And the committee. Next will be House File 412, Representative Bunn. And Representative Johnson, do you want to move the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 412.
And it will go to the Commerce Committee.
To the Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Johnson moves the House File 412 for passage and referral to the Commerce Committee. And we are going to set some time limits on this, so it'll be, since we've already taken a lot of testimony. So the proponents, and I've discussed this with the other party, and so we'll give roughly 8 minutes to each side, and then we'll have roughly 12, maybe a few minutes more for discussion and amendments. Representative Bunn, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is continuation of discussion of the bill. The first conversation occurred in the committee meeting that was held in Woodbury on February 9th. At that time, there was considerable public testimony related to this bill and another bill. Most of it was in relation to a different bill, though, having to do with attorney fees and warranty claims. This bill is much more limited in scope and is really more of a technical fix to clarify language in a bill that became an amendment in 2004. What this bill is about is the fact that prior to 2004, there was no statute of repose for warranty, new home or home improvement warranty claims, i.e. there was no year beyond which a legal action could be made. According to the actual reading of the language in the 2004 amendment, and more importantly, the transcript of the legislative hearings and the floor debate at that time, and the intent expressed in them, is our contention that this subdivision of the statute has two distinct components. And our intent with this bill is just to make that language even clearer. The two distinct components, one has to do with establishing a statute of limitations with regards to these warranty claims, which basically indicates that a that an action has to occur within 2 years of the breach, and the breach is both discovering it and also written reporting of it and a few other follow-ups. Secondly, and this is the main part and was the main intent of the 2004 language, is that unlike in the past where there had been no ending date, there would now be a statute of repose, and that statute of repose was intended by the language and also as evidenced by the transcripts of the committee hearings and the floor discussion to be a 12-year statute of repose. So what this required, just to repeat it again, was that the claim has to be within 2 years of the breach or discovery and reporting, and that in any event, and in all circumstances, the claim has to be, the action has to occur within 12 years. Why this bill is necessary is in the subsequent period, in the 2004-2007 period, different levels of courts interpreted the language in different ways, and consumers and homeowners were caught in the middle on that, and there was a variable treatment in our state and across courts on this. Secondly, it's also the case that in 2007, with what's referred to as the Gomez decision, it essentially went against the original intent completely and basically said everything, all claims had to be within 10 years, which is the stated warranty on many aspects of home repairs. But it's clear from the original language the 12-year repose was always the intent. So I'm just going to stop with that, and then I have Attorney Scott Andresen here, and he's going to follow up on, first of all, talking about that legal history briefly, the interpretation problem, and secondly, refer to the evidence in the committee hearings from 2003 and 2004 and from before discussion in support of what the original intent was.
Mr. Andresen.
Chair Mulready, committee, thank you for taking my testimony. I've represented hundreds of homeowners in warranty disputes with builders over the years, and that provides the background for my knowledge of this issue. I'm here to support this amendment because I think it is, in fact, what the legislature intended to do back in 2004. And I'll just briefly point out what some of the problems are as the language is currently drafted. What happened is in 2004, if you'll see on this bill with the line out, prior to 2004, this subdivision 4 of the statute had language that said this section does not apply to actions based on breach of statutory warranties. In 2004, that language got removed and replaced by the words for the purposes of. Okay? Now, I'm not sure why. There's no discussion in all of the testimony, and I've read all of it, as to why that change was made. But what has happened is, in that short, small change, which seems to me to do nothing, one is a sort of a positive way of saying the same thing, the other is a negative way of saying it, but it seems clear that Subdivision 4 is meant to apply to statutory warranty claims. But the Court of Appeals has interpreted that change, which is in 2004, to mean that Subdivision 4 of this statute isn't the only subdivision that applies to a warranty claim. So now they've decided that the court should look to subdivision 1 of the section, which is section 541.051, and subdivision 4. Okay? And the problem is that subdivision 1 says that all causes of action that are covered by subdivision 1 must accrue within 10 years. Okay? But subdivision 1 doesn't talk about what it means for a warranty claim to accrue, right? the Supreme Court has decided that a warranty claim accrues, meaning the time at which you can bring a warranty action, when a homeowner discovers a problem, gives their builder written notice as required by the statute, waits a period of time under the notice and opportunity to repair provision of this bill for their builder to respond as to whether or not they'll help them, if they'll take care of the problem. And it is only when the builder says, no, I won't help you, or I can't help you, that there's actually a breach of that warranty. Okay? That's when the cause of action for a warranty claim accrues. That's different than if someone's just suing a builder for negligence. That cause of action accrues the moment they discover there's a problem with their home. Right? The problem that this Gomez case creates is it is having the courts and lawyers apply both Subdivision 1 and Subdivision 4. As a result of that, this is a 10-year warranty. 327A gives people a 10-year warranty on their home. Okay? And in 2004, the legislature said there's got to be that an end date at some point under which you can bring a lawsuit based on that 10-year warranty. But it's not necessarily at 10 years. What if you don't discover that you have a warranty problem until the day before the 10th year? Do you now have to bring your lawsuit the same day? The way the Gomez court has interpreted this, that's exactly what would have to happen. In one day, you'd have to discover your problem, call the builder, write the builder, have the builder tell you to go pound sand, and then file your lawsuit. And if you don't do all that, you're out of luck under Gomez because they're applying Subdivision 1. That isn't what the legislature intended. Having read the transcript, the legislature, I think it is clear, intended to give people time even after the warranty period expires to discover a problem and bring and go to the builder, and hopefully the builder will take care of it. But if they won't, you still have time to bring your claim. And I would go back, this is back in the House Committee on Commerce, Jobs, and Economic Development from April of 2003. And this is Representative Atkins at the time was describing the amendment that we're now seeking to amend again. And maybe he's behind me or something. I suspect from the eyes that I'm perfect. But I'm reading that says, here it is. My intent with this bill in 2004 is that they, homeowners, have 2 years from the end of the warranty to discover it. Not that they discover it 1 hour before the warranty is over. That's not my intent. Under the law as it is currently interpreted and currently drafted, that's exactly how the courts are enforcing it. That you have to discover this problem within your warranty period and tell the builder about it and have the builder tell you to go pound sand before you can bring your lawsuit. They've effectively shortened the 10-year warranty period with that interpretation. This amendment will clarify to say you still have a 2-year statute of limitations, right? But you have to bring your lawsuit within 12 years of the warranty date, period. It couldn't be more clear. There will be no confusion in the courts. There won't be any confusion with lawyers who are advising homeowners or builders. It will be that clear. So I'd ask that you support it.
Thank you. And we have somebody from the Builders Association.
Can I ask a question?
There'll be questions after this.
Good afternoon, Chairman Mallory, members of the committee. I'm Lisa Frenette. I'm with the Builders Association of Minnesota. We respectfully oppose this legislation. We believe right now that the law is clear on a time certain of when you can bring forward a claim. It allows a person to come forward, bring a claim, and go into an extra 2 years if they bring the claim within the ninth and the tenth year. We also believe that this could set bad precedent. What happens if somebody brings forward a claim at the end of the 12th year, the last day, and they feel that they need to have some sort of legal remedy also? Are we going to extend it out further after that point when somebody decides that? With all due respect, and looking back at the Gomez case, the Gomez's dragged their court case out an extra 6 years before bringing their claim. They had 6 years of the builder trying to fix the problem, and the builder trying to fix the problem before they decided to bring the action at the very end of the 10 years. Thank you very much.
That's good. You were much shorter than your 8. 8 minutes. By the way, the proponents had exactly 8 minutes. we'll go to the questions then. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, this isn't the first time I've heard this particular problem. So I'm going to ask anyone at the table, is this a homeowner's problem, a builder's problem, or an insurer's problem? And it certainly seems like it gets dragged out in court and everything. It all goes back to actually getting somebody trying to blame somebody else. So am I in on this, or am I seeing a new bill? I'll go with the guy at the end.
All right. I don't think you're in on it. I'm hoping you'll participate in fixing it a little bit. But you're right. What happens in these cases is that a homeowner discovers a problem with their house. They call up their builder, or they write them a letter and say, will you help me? And unfortunately, today we have a lot of bigger problems with homes, water intrusion, mold cases that everybody's read about, where we're talking about repairs that are in the nature of $50,000, $100,000, $200,000. And whether it's the builder saying, I'm not going to help you because I don't stand behind my work, which isn't my general experience, usually it's the builder saying, I can't afford to fix your problem. So what do? They say, I'm going to turn it over to my insurance company. That's why I have insurance. And then their insurance company says, well, wait a minute. You know, we're not here to insure you for your bad work. It's only if it causes damage. And then we fight about whether there's damage. And then ultimately there's a lawsuit, and the insurance company for the builder decides we ought to try and spread the blame between the builder and all the subcontractors. And they all have insurance. And they all get lawyers. And then we get into this morass of litigation for a year or two. That's what we do. And unfortunately, I spent the better part of the last 8 months in one particular case litigating the exact issue we're here to discuss with this bill. And that is, what did the legislature mean to do in 2004 when you fixed what I'll call the Coase case, the fact that there was no end date? Because the testimony seems perfectly clear what was meant to happen, but the interpretation of the Court of Appeals is different. And I had even different courts. I had trial courts tell me multiple times, this is a 12-year statute of repose that was created in 2004. And that's what people operated under until the Court of Appeals said, no, it's not. So what helps bring these cases to completion, although this bill isn't going to solve the problem, I don't want anybody to think that I'm saying it's going to solve the problem, but what it will help do is provide clarity. Clarity makes things more efficient, and therefore homeowners spend less money and they don't have to litigate nearly as much, nor do the builders.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
This maybe brings clarity in the courtroom, but frankly, the only place that there needs to be clarity is the insurance policy, and I mean, this is like the eighth or tenth kind of issue, same issue, different bill that I've heard, deals with mold and water damage. I'm just a pipe fitter. I can figure out the insurance companies that are screwing people. So is there a bill out there that's going to take the insurance companies and force them to do what they're supposed to do, their contract says? Please?
Representative Bond, do you want
to... Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney. I just want to mention there are several different bills out there this year related to this whole area of water intrusion and homeowner protection, and some of them address some of the issues you raised in terms of insurance companies. More fundamentally, though, when you said, well, what's this really all about, is that I would hope that all of us can work together, including with the building association, including with the whole area of inspection, to really prevent this from getting legal or insurance. I think our goal going forward in the next couple of years is to deal with the level of prevention of all of this, because by the time it gets to this level, it's a tragedy for all the families and the homeowners involved.
Well, and Representative Bunn, I was just reading through the proceedings in the Commerce Committee, of which both Representative Atkins and I were on, and he was asking questions, and I came across my statement after hearing what the purpose of the bill was, and I said that the language was confusing and might have problems later. But I do want to point out to everybody, I also looked at the transcript of the proceedings on the floor of the House when the author of the bill explained very simply what it does. He says, this is quotes, "What it does is just defines in statutes for the courts that no lawsuits can be filed for sure after 12 years of substantial completion of the building," end of quote. So that's what the author of the bill said at the time on the House floor when we all voted on it. Representative Champion, you had a question.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if this is an appropriate question because we are not entertaining the amendment at this particular time. We're just dealing with the bill in its original form, correct?
We'll get to that in a few minutes.
Okay. And so perhaps then I'll wait until that time because it appears that my comments are more so around this question.
Okay. And Mr. Andreessen, I was just actually reading the statutes this afternoon, 541-051 subdivision 1. It looks to me like the Gomez court, and maybe I'm wrong, but did they confuse the date of accrual of the action with the date of the end of the statute of limitations?
Chair Mulry, I don't know if they confused it or if they just
didn't understand it.
What the accrual is and how they did point out that the accrual differs for a warranty claim as opposed to a negligence claim, but they didn't point out how that then interacts with now having two different statutes of limitations and statutes of repose applicable to warranty claims. There still is nothing in Subdivision 1. Mm-hmm. Subdivision 1 was not amended in 04. There's nothing in that subdivision that would make it applicable to warranty claims any more so than it was in 2002 when the Supreme Court said Subdivision 1 does not apply to warranty claims, period. And that was the Vallejos decision.
No, I agree. But even if you look at 1, it says no action, cause of action can accrue more than 10 years. Well, then it also says you have 2 years from the discovery of it. So if it accrues within the 10 years, you have two more years, up to 12 years to bring the action. So I don't know if they understood this whole thing, but hopefully today we can get it straightened out. Is there any more questions before we go to the Westrom amendment? Representative Weston, did you have a question, or are you going to move your amendment? Okay, go ahead with your question.
Question, Mr. Chair, maybe for Mr. Andreessen or Anderson. Just looking at the three levels of warranties, what is the difference between the 1 year, the two year? I understand it's more mechanical plumbing. The 1 year and the 10 year, are they not quite similar? And how narrow does it go? Does it get down to the flooring wasn't installed correctly? Shouldn't have had seams and pathways. Wasn't good flooring. Does it the sheetrock isn't holding in the ceiling like it should? Does it get into that type of stuff, or is it structural? I'm not sure I understand the difference between the 1 and the 10 year, and what different causes of actions would you bring after year 1 that you.
Mr. Andreessen?
Representative Westrom, the 1 year warranty is a warranty against defects that are caused by faulty workmanship or failure to follow building codes. Okay? So that could be something as straightforward as, like you say, you didn't lap the weather barrier properly beneath the siding of the house. Okay? That would be a code violation because it's required to be lapped one way. That would be a violation of the 1 year warranty under the statute. The 10 year warranty could be triggered by that exact same event, except that the 10 year warranty is triggered when there is what they call major structural damage to the house, meaning it's affecting the load-bearing portions of the home. So if that mislapping of the weather barrier went unchecked for, say, 9 years, and then somebody figured it out when it started to rain inside their home, and they opened it up and realized all the studs were rotting, now you've triggered the 10-year structural warranty as well as the 1-year warranty for workmanship defects and code violations.
Okay.
Does that explain the difference?
It does. So essentially, you have to have something that's going to affect it structurally and discover it within that 10-year period. If I'm correct, you can just let me know that. But to follow up on the bill, the whole need for it, we're still talking. You have to discover this on year 9, day 365 or before. Or are we talking that you could discover it in year 10, halfway through the year, but you still have to finish your case by the end of 12 years, so you effectively only have a year and a half to discover it and go through the right processes? Can you follow that up as well as to verify that I understood the
question? Mr. Andreessen, could you be very short?
I will.
Representative, people have to leave, and if he's going to want to do his amendment, we're going to do that immediately after a very short response.
Sure. This bill will make it clear that a homeowner could actually discover the problem beyond year 10. So they could discover it at 10 and a half years after the house was completed, but they still have to bring their lawsuit within 12 years.
Okay.
Representative Westrom, do you want to do your amendment?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we can. I'd move the A1 amendment.
Representative Westrom moves the A1 amendment, and can you explain extremely briefly, because we're over the time right now?
Well, Mr. Chair, what this amendment would do would be some of the testimony we heard out in Woodbury, and it's all related to discovery and not long enough. I guess I'd be interested in Representative Bunn's opinion on this as well, but this would allow a contractor to offer a builder or a homeowner, or the party building the house, ultimately buying it and building it to live in or to do whatever, to have a longer warranty, but they would basically put a price on that up front, and the parties that are going to get longer warranties would have two options. They either get the standard warranty under current law, or if it's going to be a 25% increase in the cost of the house, they could still buy that from the contractors.
Representative Bunn, would you prefer to have this or not have it on your bill and have it go as a separate bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate Representative Westrom's intent to try to further protect consumers. I would prefer that this go as a separate bill if it were to go forward. Two things. One is the Attorney Andreessen here indicates that this is already possible, that people want to negotiate these, they could. But secondarily, I think there's a number of issues about pricing these kinds of things and financing insurance and what it could do to the overall cost of doing these kinds of things that we know way too little about. And so I would prefer that we did not add this amendment, and that if he thinks it's worth pursuing further, he further investigate that and bring it forward as a separate bill.
Okay, thank you, Representative.
So I would oppose it at this time.
He's gone now? Mm-hmm. Is he out there anywhere? He went out the door? Mm-hmm. Okay. He had a question on this amendment. I guess then we're ready to vote on the amendment then. All in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
No. It fails. Then we're out of time on this one, and there's several people have to leave. So, let's see, it was Representative Johnson renews his motion to pass House File 412 and it goes to the Commerce Committee. We're in the middle of a vote right now, Representative Westrom. All in favor say aye.
Sure, we're just
aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Oh. Carries. Thank you, members. The next bill is the Atkins bill, House File 417. And we've talked it over with both parties here. And we'll have about roughly 12 minutes to each side. And then about 15 minutes of discussion, and I believe there aren't any amendments. That's my understanding. Is that correct from both sides? Okay. Thank you. Who would like to move the bill? Representative Mahoney moves House File 417 to pass and goes to the general register from here. Representative Atchins, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's nice to have legislative history quoted back to me as I'm sitting in the in the back here, but I'll try not to stutter and say and so forth, as I never knew that people were watching us so closely in terms of creation of that. But this is a very simple bill. It was brought to me on behalf of the Minnesota Business Policy Holders Coalition. It's a group of businesses ranging in size from as few as 4 employees to as many as 12,000. And a whole bunch of them in between that. It's a very simple bill. It says if you need to bring a claim against your own insurance company for which you've paid thousands and thousands of dollars for in premiums over the years, and if you eventually bring a claim, that if you prevail on that claim, that you are then also made whole. You get the amount of your claim plus whatever it took to bring the claim that was originally denied. You get to get your attorney's fees if you've had any, and you get to get interest on that. The reason for this is, I'll give you just a quick example. Let's assume that you have you've got a $500,000 policy, and your restaurant burns down, and you present the claim for that, and you're denied. You just want the $500,000 so you can get back in business, you can rebuild, get going again. You present the claim, you're denied, you go through, and you end up going through years of litigation, all sorts of expenses. You finally get the amount that you were entitled to, for which you paid all these premiums over the years. You get your money from your insurance policy, but you've incurred $300,000 or $400,000 in attorney fees and expenses. So you get the $500,000 to rebuild your restaurant, but you're out $300,000 for attorney fees and expenses and all of that, and you can no longer rebuild your restaurant. It also provides for interest. If you were to go off during the course of this, you've been denied by your insurance company, you go to the bank to get the money to rebuild. The bank looks at your situation, and they probably aren't going to make you a 3% interest kind of loan, because you sit here and you've been denied by your own insurance company. There's a question mark how much you're going to get back, whether you're going to get it at all. So you end up paying a high interest rate just to go and get the money that the insurance company should have paid you in the first place. So this provides for a 12% interest rate as well, which isn't unrealistic in light of what a bank would make a loan to you at, just so you can get that business going again. It's to level the playing field. It's to make the insured whole. The leveling of the playing field, I might add, right now an insurance company, if you bring a frivolous claim or a false claim against your insurance company, they can get attorney's fees against you. There's also criminal penalties against you. All this does is it doesn't quite make the playing field level, but it moves it in the right direction. And with that, I have an outstanding witness here who can tell you a story of what happened to their company.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Liz Porter, and I'm an employee from St. Jude Medical. As you might know, we're a medical device manufacturer with our global headquarters in St. Paul. We employ roughly 2,200 people in the Twin Cities. We've recently had a large expansion in Little Canada. We make products to treat cardiac-related conditions as well as chronic pain management. The focus of our employees and our true passion is to make medical devices make great products. As you might guess, though, in our industry, despite every effort we might make to make a very good, top-tier product, there is inherent risk in our industry. In addition to that, there's a very aggressive litigation climate. So, as good corporate citizens, we purchase insurance, commercial liability insurance. Year after year, we have purchased this insurance and paid significant premiums. We expect our carriers to be there for us when we encounter a loss, but that has not been our experience. We've been sued by 3 insurance carriers since 1996, and we have 2 insurance coverage disputes presently ongoing. In the first case, just to give you an idea, St. Jude Medical was sued in 2 class actions. We notified our carrier right away. We cooperated with them. We shared information with them regularly. The carrier monitored but refused to participate or participate in any settlement. We sought coverage. The carrier launched a 13-month investigation. We produced thousands of documents to them, the vast majority of which we had already provided to them. After 13 months of this coverage investigation, the carrier denied coverage and said they were unwilling to cooperate or compromise, and then they filed suit against us. So we've been litigating that piece of litigation for another year and a half beyond the 13-month coverage investigation. The hallmark of these cases is very aggressive discovery, unnecessary discovery demands from the carrier, the only purpose being to drive up our attorney's fees, cause us to keep incurring attorney's fees, and they really have no incentive to settle on their side. They've also, in the meantime, got your insurance proceeds, and they can be making money off your money, you know, what we see as our insurance proceeds. It's also a huge drain on the company's resources. In this particular litigation, we had key product development people that were required to take time away from their roles in developing new products to help us in the litigation. The second piece of coverage litigation involved a product. We made a very conservative move in 2000. We recalled a heart valve product. Litigation followed. Again, we notified our carrier right away, cooperated, regularly shared information. There were layers of coverage in this situation. Five layers covered the loss. The sixth layer, which has $50 million, has flatly denied coverage and has now sued us. So we are in a difficult position of defending the litigation while we're simultaneously fighting our insurance carrier. The same kind of behavior is happening as in the other case. We have repeated overburdensome discovery demands. The carrier basically is trying to relitigate the underlying litigation. Again, the purpose is to drive up the attorney's fees that they know we can't recover. The drawn-out litigation simply allows them to hold on to the money longer, the insurance proceeds, $50 million, and again, no incentive to settle. So I urge your support of this bill. It's a serious problem to St. Jude Medical. We want to focus our energy and our employees' time on making new great products, a life-saving product. And we also want to be expanding our company and growing, and I think that has, you know, a significant impact, especially here in Minnesota. If, with your indulgence, I would ask if I could comment. I have testimony from two other companies. They gave testimony before the other House committee, and I would ask you if I could just take a few minutes and summarize their testimony.
Representative Atkins, do you want to use up your time in that way, or have the other witnesses?
Mr. Chair, I think it's more important that you hear about stories that are happening to real Minnesota businesses. We've got Mr. Mielenhausen here, practices in this field. We'll save him for comments or questions afterwards.
Okay. That's fine.
I'll be very brief.
Go ahead, Ms. Porter.
Thank you. Dale Johnson, I believe, from Andion Corporation, testified last week. Their business is smaller than St. Jude Medical. It's a $30 million business. They make cardiopulmonary products. They had a similar experience. They received a product liability claim in 2003. They notified their carriers. They were led by the carrier to believe that they had coverage. The carrier again launched an investigation that took over a year. The carrier then sued Andion. In the meantime, Andion had to proceed and settle the product liability claim and then, of course, also litigate their coverage question. The court found in Andion's favor, and Andion did get paid, not the full value of the claim, but they did get paid for some of the claim. But, of course, lots of attorney's fees that they were not compensated for. And, you know, it took 3 years for them to get partial coverage on that claim. So it's just another example. Dale Johnson has now moved to North Star Beef, and he ran into the same problem when he started working with that company. Ann Archambault is with ABC Bus Company, and this is, again, I think a good example of a smaller company. It's 30 years old, family-owned. They have a base of operations in Faribault. They make highway coaches. In her testimony, she talks about two coaches that have been damaged, $400,000 worth of damage, property damage. Again, they submitted claims which were wrongfully denied or significantly delayed. I thought it was interesting that Ann said she had worked at the company for 9 years, and this was something she has dealt with continually throughout her time there. She said on a monthly basis she's dealing with these situations. So I think I'll just add, too, she said, we can't sustain these losses over a long period of time, given the size of the company and the amount of the losses. It's not only large dollars litigating with your carrier, but you're trying also to deal with your underlying, you know, damage claim to your property or defending your product liability case. So I hope this has given you some idea from, you know, small to large of what the situation is. And again, in the testimony of all of these companies, we all want to get back to doing what we do, you know, running buses and making medical devices. So, again, I urge your support, and I really appreciate your attention.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, that's essentially what we have at this time. We're just looking to make these folks whole, put them in the place that they would have been had the claim not been denied, get them what they paid for.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Stay around and speak some questions, probably. Would the opponents come up and duke it out between yourselves as to how you split up your 12 minutes? There's apparently eight, so you get a little less than 2 minutes each, unless you can agree with some people to get the major part of it. Mr. Johnson, I guess you're first, so can you organize them?
Chair,
Mr. Hesse.
For the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Let me just touch briefly on what the Chamber has done the last couple of months to deal with this particular issue. We convened a series of meetings, three meetings, with the proponents and opponents of the legislation to try to see if there could be any compromise crafted. When we made no progress towards that end, the staff brought a recommendation to the Chamber's Board of Directors on a way to that we think is fair to address this issue. And it would be to adjust the prejudgment interest rate not by to the 12% level that's in the current bill, but to bump up the existing prejudgment interest rate, which is the greater of 4% or the one-year constant maturity rate. We bump that up by 3 percentage points, so the greater of 4% or the one-year constant maturity rate plus 3. The board took a position in opposition to the attorney fee provision in the legislation. So, Mr. Chair and members, that's where the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is at the moment, suggesting maybe a way to address some of the concerns that the proponents raise. But again, the Chamber's board took a position against the attorney fee portion of this legislation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hickey. Mr. Johnson, you got somebody else? Mr. Hickey?
Mr. Chairman, members, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. We're the state's largest business group in terms of entities with over 13,000 members in this state and a significant number base in every one of your districts. And do you prefer if I don't go with the 20-minute prepared statement then? Or
Mr. Hickey, if you want to come back around 8 o'clock tonight, we'll turn on the lights. We'll have somebody turn on the lights for you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's the first time I've had the pleasure in your committee, so congrats on your chairmanship and everything. Just wanted to make a couple brief comments. We're involved in this two-year battle that occurred last year, and a little surprise, there's going to be a round three this year. A lot of time and energy was put into this. I think a pretty good compromise was reached last year. Total damages above and beyond your policy of $250,000. Attorney's fees of up to $100,000 was reached last year at the end of a two-year battle that had a lot of sagas, because I saw a lot of it going on. And so this year's bill came by. We did do a poll our members to do a survey, and our members did oppose it. I think the thought by our members is that this bill is initially drafted. I know the authors made some changes, which we appreciate, but it's a windfall for maybe that rare small business and most people believe that if you pass this kind of law, that most that premiums are going to go up, and the vast majority of small businesses that aren't going to be in this situation are going to pay higher premiums. It's going to be a windfall for that rare or a few small business owners. And so I think that that's how they felt about it. That's clearly what the vote indicates. But it's just, you know, the damage, the consequential or monetary consequential damages or projected future damages has been dropped. But with that kind of provision, who knows what it will cost, you know, and who's going to pay for that? Well, clearly the other policyholders. So I think that that was the thought behind that. Obviously, that's been taken out of the bill, and we appreciate that. Bumping up the percentage on judgment, on pre-judgment interest would certainly be helpful. But the original bill, we are opposed to it, and we were involved in the bill the previous years, too. So I appreciate the time and urge you to not move forward on this.
Representative Johnson, can you wait with your question until the question period? Okay, thank you. Mr. Johnson, are you next?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Beverly Turner, and I'm with Travelers Insurance Company. Travelers is the largest property casualty company within the state with a significant number of jobs in Minnesota. And we strongly oppose this legislation and respectfully ask for your no vote on it. Simply put, increasing insurance litigation costs is going to increase insurance premium costs for the policyholders because they do get spread out to the policyholders and spread down to them. First of all, there are occasions where there are legitimate coverage disputes, and we have to do the due diligence in looking at those coverage disputes, so there does have to take some time when there are these legitimate disputes. And in order to be fair to all our policyholders. Secondly, we do not delay claims in order to make money off of any type of float. We are a conservative insurance company in our investments, and we use our investments to pay our claims. Our rate of return in 2007 on our investments was below 4%, which is actually, and in 2008, we don't know those numbers, but I'm sure they'll be much less based on the economic conditions we're seeing today. So obviously not in the business of making money off of any float, because there simply isn't any. Finally, I just wanted to address that our claims data shows that the longer that we have an outstanding claim pending, the more that we end up paying. So we are actually motivated to settle our claims quickly in order to pay, not extend it out and pay as much. So it's in our interest, as well as the policyholder interest, to pay claims promptly and to resolve matters as expeditiously as we possibly can. And we tell our attorneys this as well. We ride our attorneys hard so that they do settle claims and get them taken care of and to make sure that our policyholders are satisfied with the result and not try to drag them out. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Johnson?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota, the trade association of quite a few companies operating in the state. And just three quick points, Mr. Chairman. I know there's the time's limited. But from our industry perspective, we oppose House File 417 in its current form, urge the committee to vote no. First, we don't need it. We have a remedy that passed last year, the Minnesota statute, the 604.18, the first party bad faith basis statute that's been commented on. I think from an industry perspective, we find it disappointing and would love the opportunity, not tonight, but at another time to come in and to talk about businesses come to you and to the committee and contend bad actions on the part of insurers. And I know who the insurer was for North State Beef. They'd love to come and talk. This is an open file. We can't come to the podium and give you the other side. And I will assure the committee there is an other side of the North Star Beef case. And it'd be nice if we could get both sides to the table, but unless the company gives permission, it's not in litigation. It's an ongoing claim. In fact, it's not in court. It's a live claim that's being processed right now. So whether it's that, whether it's the St. Jude, we assume it's the Silzone heart cell, class action lawsuit. So, Mr. Chairman, that's just the reality. We understand that, but I would love to have an opportunity at some point to shed more light on so you could hear both sides and you make a judgment of whether the company was engaged in whatever kind of conduct or behavior in not processing the claim. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, again, the remedy that was passed, and Deb Turner has covered those points, we don't think this legislation is necessary. We urge you to vote no. A lot of other groups oppose the bill that you've heard from in part, and I'll stop and let the other witnesses testify.
Thank you, Mr. Marsh. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be really quick. We appreciate the language in the bill that exempts the 67A township mutuals, but I want to make sure that there's an understanding that we have several companies that are in Chapter 66 that this applies to, as well as last year's bad faith proposal. We also have larger companies, six larger companies that we buy reinsurance and we package with, as well as they are direct writers, that this legislation, as well as last year's bad faith proposal, applied to. Our board of directors has taken a position that we, as an industry, compromised last year in the bad faith proposal. We think that that legislation needs time to work, and let's monitor it, and over the next few years we'll see what needs to be changed, if anything. And therefore, this is a really another version of bad faith. We do not need it. So our position of our board is that we strongly oppose this proposal. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, are there other, there's about 3 minutes left.
Chairman Mullery, committee members, my name is Elaine Love. I'll just take about a minute because I'm from New Jersey and I can talk really fast.
Okay.
So I worked for Farmers on and Off for about 31 years. And we insure 6,000 small businesses in Minnesota. So the comments that I'm making address the impact of the bill on those 6,000 smaller businesses. This legislation addresses pretty much large corporations and commercial insurers. These are sophisticated entities that can work together to solve the coverage question. And as Ms. Porter pointed out, with large companies with medical devices and other products such as that, there are many levels and layers of coverage, and they can be very complex. And I think the legislation mostly addresses those. Small businesses generally have one insurer, very simple contracts. They can work it out, so they would really not benefit from any of the provisions of this bill. So our concerns are twofold. Number one, there's really no downside in this arrangement because it is a one-sided agreement, where if the insurers prove that there really isn't coverage, they still pay their bills. So right now everybody pays their own bills. We think that's a more appropriate way to do it. If the insurers are paying, reimbursing their policyholders for their legal costs, that increases claims costs. Increased claims costs over time increases premiums. So while small business owners are not going to benefit from this legislation, they will definitely be footing the bill for it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Were you going to testify or just be available for questions? Okay. I guess that's...
Kevin Mullery, Dale Thorns, Joe. I'm appearing on behalf of the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association. I think I will just defer to questions. I'm a 20-year practitioner in insurance coverage and here to provide a balance for what's going on around the country if there are any questions along that line.
Thank you. And
thank you.
I believe that Doug Franzen was going to testify, but wait, did you...
Chairman, I'll take my time. We put the written comments in.
Thank you. That will help. Thank you, Mr. Franzen. Okay, then we can go to the question and answer period. There's quite a few people you can ask questions of, and Representative Johnson, you're first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is actually one to the most recent testifiers. Maybe Bob Johnson, you could answer this. Is there any evidence to indicate that the passage of a bill like this is going to increase rate costs? Do you have any concrete evidence that you can provide us with that will demonstrate that?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, as we work through this, we've looked at other states that have changed their bad faith laws to deal with attorney's fees, you know, the damages that are recovered. So the answer is there is evidence from states, California and West Virginia, that had expansions where there was additional litigation, lawyer fee payments. Now, it didn't work just like this, so I can't tell you that there is an example with the bill, now the way it's configured before you, it's got a 12% prejudgment interest and it's got attorney fees in it. But I think the answer is that today we pay 4% prejudgment interest. So if we're going to move it to 12%, those are more dollars that are going to be paid in the claim. More claim dollar payment translates to, that's what insurance companies add up when they calculate their premium. So we're going to be paying out more money moving from 4% to 12%. I don't have the kind of statistics here tonight to quantify what that jump up is going to do, but it's going to increase the amount of payout.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you don't have any evidence that you can provide that'll demonstrate that. And I think the case of West Virginia and California, I think that dealt with third-party claims, if I'm not mistaken, yep, rather than the first-party claims that we're talking about in this legislation. Is that correct?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, this isn't necessarily first-party. The ability to access these remedies on liability policies, I'm just saying that's the context that both West Virginia and California acted on. So in my opinion, it's relevant to look at the experience of what happened there. And I mean, I agree, and I said in my comments, this is different. But it's relevant to look at the experience, and when the claim payments increase, or whatever is driving that, that's what translates to the bottom line cost and premium impact of the policyholder. So again, moving 4 to 12 means more money is going to be paid out of the system than is paid out today. More money paid out of the system is the basis of what insurers add up and decide what the premiums they're going to pay. Attorney fees today are not paid by the carriers in the way that House File 417 requires. So we operate in Minnesota under the American rule, under which each side pays their own attorney fees. Unless the legislature passes a law, House File 417 would represent a law which would change the American rule and move those costs now are going to be moving into the insurance box. So those are additional claim dollars that would be paid that are not paid today. And so when you move that, so that is the basis and that's the answer to your question. When costs like that are increased, and they clearly do, then insurance companies are going to add up those claim costs, and that's the basis that they calculate the premiums on.
Representative Johnson. Okay, Representative Holbert.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and I have a couple of questions. First, Mr. Franson said that he provided testimony to the committee in writing. Is that the letter from Ann Weber?
Yes. Mr. Franson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, yes, I should note for the record, I represent the Property Casualty Insurers of America, and we do oppose this legislation. Any further testimony might be redundant of the good reasons that were given to oppose this bill thus far.
Yes, and for the members that don't know, there was an hour and a half hearing in Representative Atkins' committee on this. Representative Holberg, you have a second question.
Mr. Chair, and these would be to the bill author or his phone a friend, I guess. You said that you
that's always a good line.
This group was the Minnesota Business Policy that you were working with. Is that, did I catch your name correctly? And can you give me some flavor from the various members of this group?
The Minnesota Business Policy Holders Coalition.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. Representative, Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, you heard from St. Jude's, Angion, ABC Bus Company, I believe 3M, Mr. Mielenhausen, who's not on the record yet, but do you have a more fuller list?
Yeah, I was afraid there
was one.
Mr. Chair, may I respond?
Go ahead.
Madam Representative, I would say that there are probably between 30 and 40 businesses that have indicated support either directly or through our informational meetings that we've had. And probably there's about a half a dozen that are active in terms of, you know, the people that we report to, but there are others that are getting information from us and have expressed some support with varying degrees of levels of, whether they're going to testify versus letters, things like that.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, does this organization include any trade groups or professional organizations, occupations?
Businesses, small to large.
Okay, and then my next question has to do with, I mean, there was some testimony about the 12%, and I guess this was 18% in a similar bill last year. And that seems pretty high if, in fact, you're also going to allow for punitive damages. And I mean, if we're talking about actual costs and actual rate of inflation, that seems to make more sense to me. Why the 12%?
And Representative Chair Atkins?
Representative Holberg, we're not off in some extreme world here. I believe there's 22 other states allow interest at 10% or more. 21 other states allow the assessment of attorney's fees if the business prevails. So what we tried to do was pick something that that other states are already doing. And I might add, in those other states, the rates are not higher than what is being charged in Minnesota.
And Mr. Chair, when you say allow, so it would be up to the judge to determine the rate of interest or the way your bill is written?
There's
Mr.
Chair, Representative Holberg, yes.
Okay, and
it's
then
up to
Representative Holberg.
And then can you talk to me a little bit about your effective date, existing or arising on or after that date? And then my understanding is that with the bad faith bill that passed last year, can they layer these issues together, or do they look and say, well, this looks good, now maybe I can get interest and attorney's fees paid, so can they stop under the old law and refile, or, I mean, how does this work?
Mr. Representative Holberg, I am so glad that you asked that question, because there is apparently among some of my friends in the insurance industry this argument being made, didn't we do this last year? The answer is we passed a great bill last year that's great for the little guy with the hail claim or that's in a car accident, but it does very little for the testimony that you heard earlier. It's not going to make a hail or a bit of difference in the drop in the ocean's worth of difference to folks like that have attorney's fees that are well in excess of $250,000 or $350,000 that might be available under that law. You've got a claim being made for $9 or $12 or $15 million that's at stake that's been denied for a long, long time. Attorney's fees in the six or seven figures. Last year's bill isn't going to put them into the place that they would have been. This does make them whole.
I'm sorry, and I'll just try and get clarification. This will be my last question. I'm still not understanding if could, because it was existing, cause of accident existing, does that mean it could have happened 5 years ago, 3 years ago? How does this work? I mean, generally we make laws going to effect and moving forward, and so is there any prohibition of look back time or stacking, or if I didn't think I had a good enough shot over the law last year, can I file a different claim on the same issue when this law, if it's passed, or?
Thank you. Representative Holberg, I can answer that, but I think Mr. Mielenhauser might be able to do so much more succinctly. So I'm going to give him a shot at it.
Mr. Chair, Representative, basically, if a cause of action exists, it still has to be within the statute of limitations, and so if there is some existing problem with the insurance company and somebody is still within the statute of limitations and has the ability to bring the cause of action, obviously this remedial statute would apply.
And Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, he didn't give me a time frame of the statute of limitations, so.
There's a 6-year statute of limitations on breach of contract, Representative.
All right, thank you.
Representative Tamer.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Mahoney, would you meet Representative Atkins? The other guy.
I call him that for a reason.
I know, you sit next to each other. Representative Tamer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author,
Just want to make sure, Representative Atkins, this will not have to be on the public safety finance bill, will it? I am quite serious. Will this cost or save the courts any money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kamar, I would love to say that this will cause many, many more claims to be settled and it will save lots and lots of money. I don't anticipate a huge effect on Minnesota's courts one way or the other. Hopefully what it will cause is a lot of claims to be settled sooner and not have them cause a need to go on and on. But
okay. I think Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the suit fails, it appears to me that the insurer doesn't have a chance to have their attorney fees reimbursed. Is that correct?
Representative
Ashton. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, the insurer already has a right to get attorney's fees if a claim is frivolous. They can even seek criminal penalties if it's a false claim. The goal here is to just put the insured in the position that they would have otherwise been in, so the coverage that they've already paid for. This is a relationship between them and their own insurance company to just get them what they've paid for. And that's, I think, why so many other states have already done this. We've got 22 other states that allow for attorney's fees to be awarded if it's a situation with you and your own insurance company for coverage that you've already paid for.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Atkins, if it is not a frivolous claim, and simply the insurer loses on what appears for face value to be a legitimate claim, the insurer is not reimbursed for their attorney's fees from the other side. Is that correct?
Representative Atkins.
And I thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Drazkowski, you said if the insurer loses, you're talking about if the insured loses?
Insured, I'm sorry.
Okay, that's correct. If it's a claim that moves forward and the insurance company prevails, they do not get their attorney's fees. They're already in the position that they were beforehand. This only applies to the insured, the business, that is going to be made whole as a result of it.
Representative, I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, I did mean the insurer.
Yeah.
So the insurer themselves, if the fee is deemed not, or if the suit is not deemed to be frivolous, and the insurer loses, are they under this bill? Would they have the opportunity to be reimbursed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Drazkowski just said the same thing, but the answer is no. They can't get their attorney's fees from the little business.
Thank you.
Seeing no further discussion, who was it? Oh, Representative Mahoney renews his motion to pass House File 417 and send it to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries. Thank you.
Chair and members, thank you.
Representative David. Representative Davids, I guess somehow this got on the calendar. I didn't realize who the author was. I remember 6 years of bills in your committee that without hearing.
Mr. Chairman, are you still mad at me?
Of course not.
Oh,
<geez.
laughs>
Did you get the memo on treats?
I remember many years of committee hearings where I had to bring treats.
Well, Representative Mahoney, if you got a bill heard in front of Representative David, that was a real accomplishment for Democrats. But
oh, I got my bill heard. I just had to bring an equity.
Oh, so now we know how it got heard in that committee. Would somebody like to?
to anybody that holds Representative Davidsville. Representative Scott moves House File 534.
Thank you, Representative Scott.
And to the General Register. Representative Davids, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 534 is simply a bill that clears up some issues with certificates of insurance that have become somewhat confusing over the last few years. It has to be the issuance of permits. It permits insurance companies, insurance agents to provide third party with certificates of evidence of insurance. What we're looking at here is it requires a certificate, as you see in Subdivision 3, requires a certificate of property and casualty insurance coverage to state that it has not changed the coverage. There's been some requests from some entities that are insured to change coverage that's actually in the policy. And agents are being requested to do this, and all insurance agents are good, upstanding, upright, honest people, and they don't want to do that.
Representative Davids, would you repeat the last four sentences?
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chairman. Basically, what's been happening out there is there's times when insurance agents are being asked to issue certificates of insurance with coverage that isn't on the policy. This just very clearly states very simply that you cannot put something on certificate of insurance that is not on the insurance policy and expand insurance company to the insurer in any way.
Well, Representative Davids, that's what I thought I read when I looked at this bill this afternoon, and it seems to me that if I'm a consumer and I go into you as an agent and you say, okay, you put on my binder or my commitment, whichever you call it, the insurance binder or the insurance commitment, that I get coverage for something, what this bill seems to say is I don't get coverage for that if that's outside of the underlying policy.
No, Mr. Chairman, basically what we're saying is we will write down on the certificate of insurance what coverage you have, no more, no less. And if I could, Mr. Chairman, I would like to have Mr. Spazzetto make a few comments, and then I have a witness, David Shapansky, from the Gary Insurance Center, that would like to make a few brief remarks, if we could.
Well, Representative David, could you first answer my question?
What was the question?
Is it correct that if I'm going to you and you say on the binder that I have coverage for something and the underlying insurance policy doesn't have that, I would lose that coverage under this bill, wouldn't I?
No, Mr. Chairman, it doesn't apply to binders. It has to do with certificates of insurance. And all this bill does is it says what's on that certificate of insurance has to be on the policy, cannot be expanded in any way. Well, this doesn't have to do with binders, Mr. Chairman. This has to do with certificates of insurance.
Go ahead.
I'm different.
Mr. Chairman, Dominic Spazzetto. I'm representing the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents Association. This issue relates to certificates of insurance, which are clearly just a one-page document that provides proof of an insurance policy. The insurance policy has already been written. The policy already has it. It comes to be needed frequently when there is a contractor contracting with another contractor, a general or a subcontractor, and part of their agreement is that the subcontractor carries insurance. And this document is just proof that that subcontractor has insurance. And it's basically put on a standardized form that's created by an organization called Accord. It's a simple one-page form that has information about the insurance policy, the insured, and various things like that. What we're seeing now are some of the general contractors are actually making changes on the certificate to change terms or change notifications that are different than what's in the underlying policy. And so what we're trying to say here is that we're basically taking this issue, and instead of trying to come up with a new way to do certificates or put them on online or just send people policies, we're trying to regulate ourselves by telling insurance agents you can't sign a certificate, you can't alter a certificate that's a filed form, you can't make changes that aren't consistent with what's in the policy. So even though you're requested by your policyholder, and in some cases they need the certificate to get the job or need the certificate to get paid, we can't change the certificate. So by passing this law, we'll basically go back to using the standardized forms as proof of insurance coverage, which we think is adequate.
Mr. Spicetta, if that was true and it only affected the insurance agent or the issuer of the certificate, I wouldn't have a problem. But Subdivision 6 says that it limits the agent's or producer's authority, and so the person that's relying on this insurance certificate can't rely on what they've received, it seems to me.
Mr. Chairman, if you look at Subdivision 6, it's basically saying that the agent can only put on that certificate what is included in the insurance policy and cannot put any coverage on that it does not provide.
And Representative Champion, you also do this. How are you reading these?
I'm reading it that same way, actually. I think the issue is, Representative David, if a third party relies to their detriment and later it is determined that the provided certificate is incorrect, then what happens to the person who relied to their detriment on that certificate?
Thank you, Representative Champion. That's what I'm trying to get at, too.
Mr. Chairman, let me first the Subdivision 6, and then I'll answer more directly your question. Subdivision 6 basically says that an insurance agent can't issue an opinion letter or other correspondence different than a certificate that would be an attempt to do the same thing. So if you provide a certificate, then you can't be requested to come back and provide a letter that says that you have a different coverage than in the policy. So it's sort of covering the issue of the certificate, going beyond that to say they couldn't provide a letter or other correspondence that provides any coverage or any notification requirements that are different than it's in the policy. Because the policy is the underwriting document. Now, to your question, Representative, if there is a case where there is a certificate issued that has different coverage or different requirements than the policy, what will happen is that it will probably be settled in court. The insurance company is only required to do what they are required under law, which is in the policy. So basically, the insurance agent is on the line for that mistake or that information, and it flows back to our errors and omissions or malpractice coverage, and that's one of the reasons why we're trying to clarify this, because we're seeing this throughout the country, and our insurers are telling us you better fix this because it's creating an exposure for the insurance agent that's providing information that isn't accurate, and so we want to stop it.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Well, it appears to me, based on my reading of this legislation and my understanding of the law, is that we would end up putting an innocent person in harm's way without there being any real clarity as to what should or could not happen. Because if I am the person who has hired a contractor, for an example, to come and do some work, as a requirement, I say, hey, I need to have a certificate that shows that you are in fact covered. They provide for me that certificate that's on the letterhead or at least it has some of the insurance language on it that would lead me to believe that they are covered. I could even pick up the phone and call the agent and say, did you give this particular person this information? And they would respond by saying yes. Therefore, I now give them the opportunity to work. And then there's a problem. Now when this problem arises, based on my read of this legislation, now I, as a person who relied on the information that I received, now I have to litigate. There's no other option for me based on this legislation. So I hope that's clear, and perhaps you can speak to that question.
Mr. Spicetta or Mr. I'm sorry.
Hello, my name is David Sapansky. I'm an insurance agent. I've been an insurance agent for over 30 years. I operate a Gary Insurance Center in beautiful downtown North St. Paul. Thank you for the opportunity to address this subject. This subject has become a serious problem for us insurance agents. And to try to clarify this as best I can, an insurance certificate is something that, let's use this as an example, to go to your point. You hire a plumber to come to your house and do some plumbing. You're concerned that this plumber has insurance coverage, and you want to make sure that he has a policy. The plumber then calls up his insurance agent and says, please send to Mr. X, Y, or Z, the evidence that I do have insurance. We then issue, it's a standard form, it's called a certificate of insurance, and we send it to the policyholder saying that the plumbing company does have insurance coverage, and it's the policy starts on a certain date, it ends on a certain date, it provides X number of dollars amount of liability coverage, and it also would certify if they have workers' compensation coverage on it. At the bottom of it, it would put in the name of the person that the certificate is going to. And that's what would be sent to them. It would certify indeed that that person does have insurance coverage based on what's stated on this form. What's happening is that we're having people request that this form say things other than what it's supposed to say, which is just what I just went through. This is what the insurance policy says. For example, they may ask us that they want a different time frame of when the notification on the bottom is or when the policy could be canceled. The state of Minnesota has certain cancellation laws that require certain times when a policy has to, when a certain policyholder has to be notified of cancellation. The policyholder has to be notified of that, not people that just want to get these certificates. So what's happening is these certificates are being bastardized, and what we as agents need is something in writing where when these requests are made, we can go back to them and say, this is what we can give you. The law says we can't give you anything more than this. And that's essentially what we're trying to do, because this is becoming more and more of a problem with people trying to editorialize these forms. And the other part of the problem is these forms are copyrighted forms, and people are sending us these things. They're crossing out language in it and asking us to change a copyrighted form. So we're again being requested to break the law. So all we want to do is to be able to follow the law and issue a form that's been around for well before my time, and just do it the way it used to be.
Representative Champion. Well, Mr. Sposetta, it says right they don't have the authority in line 2.2, which means that it seems to me that means that we are determining and taking away, affirming that they don't have the authority to issue this scooped up certificate of insurance, but the person it's given to is relying on it. And you said that the insurance company is not liable for other than what's in the insurance policy, but as I recall, if you have apparent authority in the agent, then the insurance company is liable and has actions against the agent. That's the way it used to be when I was representing parties.
Mr. Chairman, you are correct. But I'm trying to suggest, let's not get this confused with someone purchasing insurance, like a binder. A binder is a binder, and this does not affect that. The binder, this relates only to a certificate of insurance or other correspondence that is used as evidence of coverage. And what we're saying in this subdivision is that an insurance producer does not have the authority to issue an opinion letter or other correspondence that provides coverages that the policy does not provide. So it's a prohibition against us. If we do that, the person is still covered by the coverage. There's an underlying policy there at all times. So the policy is there. If we do that, and again, if we break the law, the insurance company can come and say, well, that exceeds the coverage or exceeds the notice requirement or exceeds whatever is in the statute, and then we would be on the line, the insurance agent's D&O coverage. So the consumer would always have the underlying policy. This has to do with Morris notification. And let me say this. The certificate of insurance is mostly requested from a third party, and generally from a contractor to another contractor to show that they have coverage, because their insurance policy has said anybody you hire, you make sure that they have insurance coverage. So in a way, the industry has created its own problem by creating this layer of everyone showing that they have insurance. And it's gotten to be the point where some people are actually amending these forms to suggest that there is coverage there that isn't there, or suggest that they have notification that exceeds the notification in the document, which is similar to our state standards.
Let me ask it clearer. Representative Mahoney, we'll say, has Mahoney Plumbing, and not plumbing, heating and cooling, right?
I don't want to. I got away from the plumbing very quick. I know that would be bad. He asks for the certificate of insurance from your agent. The agent gives him something beyond this. He relies on it. Are you saying that he can't? It seems to me that then what's issued beyond the insurance policy, he can not sue on that if there was that. Are you saying that he can rely and then still sue the insurance company? Or are you saying he can only sue the errors and omissions of the agent?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I think we're getting somewhat confused by the whole term of who can sue who. Our goal is not to have a suit at all. Our goal is just to specify the coverage that's in the policy and make sure the certificate is exactly what's in the policy. And I think that's, in this case, there would be another person in between, probably Representative Mahoney and Chairman Mullery, that had requested it in the first place. So it's generally a request from one contractor to another contractor to say that you have this coverage. And on that request for the certificate, we actually send a form that has been changed. And they expect Representative Mahoney and his insurance agent to bring that form back to meet the compliance that they want for this particular project. The problem is that form has been altered. It's a filed form. It's a form that we use. It's a form that's very specific in what it says, and it's been altered. And technically speaking, we should not even deal with that. But to help our client, Representative Mahoney, make sure he gets the job or gets paid, the agents are going ahead and signing that. So we're creating a risk for the insurance agent. The coverage is there. Well, there's no doubt that the coverage is there. The question is whether we have the authority to make a change in that certificate.
Well, I don't think either Representative Champion or I got an answer, but we'll go on to Representative Hortman.
Okay.
Next is Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be kind of brief because at one point in my profession, we had to have a particular test and a form signed, and they were crossing some things out on the form. Pretty obvious the form is a voided form and everybody had to get laid off and get rehired. I don't understand. The insurance agent voiding out a part of a form should void the whole form.
Okay.
I don't quite understand how it's even a legal document anymore. So, I mean, you're asking us to police you and your agents.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct, because the other solutions to this problem are, one, to standardize the certificates and prohibit anybody, not just the agents, but prohibit anybody from changing that certificate, which we don't do here in Minnesota because there are various forms that aren't filed and people use different forms, so we're not addressing that. The second thing is, if they get to the point where the certificates are altered to the point where we don't believe that they represent the actual policy, we'll start sending the policies to everyone. And God knows no one wants to have an insurance policy delivered them. So the certificate is really just a convenience of showing that someone has insurance. And unfortunately, by altering the certificate itself, it's changing the intent of what the certificate is about. And that's what we're trying to deal with. And we're really regulating ourselves by saying it's against the law, insurance agents, for you to do this.
Well,
don't do it.
Mr. Spicetto, I just asked our legal counsel, and he agrees that this language that you have here probably stops Representative Mahoney from suing the insurer that he's relying on. I've got Representative Mahoney, are you?
I'm done.
Okay, Representative Paymark. Two people said you're up, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We, insurance company, contract or license the agent. So why are you asking us to change in law that they can't do something when you have the authority to say you can't sell our insurance if you're not following our policies? You can't contract with us if you aren't, you know, staying true to what our rules and requirements are. Why do we need a state statute to get insurance sellers to comply with what you're asking for?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't believe the problem is with the insurance companies that we represent. The requests that we have to change the certificates are coming from other third parties, general contractors, other people who would like the large construction companies that would like to have the language that they prefer and in their certificates. And we're just saying that we don't want to have to be in a situation where we have to change language in an amended form to a policy form. What we really want to do is just to streamline this to have a standardized system. And this is one way, we think, to do it without making it too cumbersome.
Representative Telstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But isn't it the agent, then, who is making the decision to make that change and putting it on the form? Because the client, right, they can say, I want you to change this for me, but you ultimately decide whether or not you're going to sell an insurance based on what it is I'm requesting, right?
Well, actually what happens is the third party has already made the change on a form, a certificate, and they send it to the insurance agent or to the, in this case, to Representative Mahoney, who brings it to his insurance agent, and the thought, we need this to get the job. So the form has already been amended. It's not being necessarily amended by the insurance agent. It's being amended by the third party requesting that the insurance agent sign it so that it has proof of coverage. And the fear is, and frankly, this is a marketplace situation. In the case of Representative Mahoney, he goes to his insurance agent. His insurance agent says, I'm not going to sign that form. But Representative Mahoney knows he needs this to get the job. He'll go to another insurance agent, and he'll shop it until someone signs it, and then he brings it forth. So it is a problem, and we're trying to address it by telling the agents, don't do it. Just stop doing it.
Well, Mr. Spicetta, I think I certainly have still a problem with the language here. Representative Champion does. Sound like Representative Hillstrom may have a problem. I think if what you're trying to do is to get your insurance agents in line so that they're not going out their scope, I don't have a problem with doing that. I do have a problem with people who are relying on, and even, and like I say, our council thinks that there's a problem here with that. And I think, Representative Davis, I think this bill really needs to be laid over until we are sure of what the language in here means. If it's to narrow it to just affect your insurance agents, okay, but if it's taking away the rights of people who are out there relying on it, I think that we may have some problems with
it. Mr. Chairman, it was never our intent to regulate anyone else. So I thought this was limiting the agent. If you feel that this affects someone else, you could take that provision out. That was not our intent to do so.
Representative Davis, I'm gonna lay over the bill so we can figure out exactly what the proper language is to get at what you want and not get at what several of us are concerned about here. So with that, the bill is laid over.
Thank you, I think. we'll have, Mr. Chairman, we'll have your people talk to my people.
Okay, motion to adjourn. Representative Kraskowski moves adjourn.